Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Matt Rich Podcast. I have a special episode today. I am going to dive deep into the discussion with a professional on the topic about the concept of evil. And today I have with me Dr. Mitchell. How are you doing today?
Very well, how are you?
Good, good. Nice to see you again. You want to introduce to yourself, like kind of the audience, who you are and what your background is?
Sure. As aforementioned, my name is Brad Mitchell. I am a behavioral psychologist. Spent about 15 or 20 years working in the field of behavior modification, and most of my research and most of my studies have been on behaviorism and behavior modification. But I've also on the more personal side and on the side. I've done a lot of research in consciousness and kind of the interplay between the art and science of psychology.
Interesting. What got you into that field of work and what led you into there?
No, it's funny. I've had a lot of people ask me that over the years, and I can look back to high school and taking, you know, that first psych, which would be the equivalent of psych 101, and being intrigued by the fact that that psychology is a science, but there is it's one of the few sciences where there's a high art content to it, meaning that, you know, we use the scientific method in practice. I'm always using, you know, the best practices that have been scientifically either shown to be effective or are the best. But then there's so much to psychology that I would put under the umbrella of art. That it's not scientific. You know, consciousness is one of the top questions. I think it was number two a few years ago when I think it was Science Magazine asked the top questions that haven't been answered in consciousness. What is consciousness was number two, coming just behind where do we come from, both from the Big Bang Theory and both from just where do we come from. So absolutely love the idea that we are doing things scientifically in psychology, but there's still some mystery there.
Yeah, interesting. And that's why one of the subjects I was fascinated by recently was evil. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was to discuss that, because there is, I would say that psychologists would probably come to the conclusion that everything can be explained within the brain, right? Like behavioral wise, eventually, whether we don't know it yet, it could maybe science hasn't caught up to that yet. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think that's the big question, and I think that's the giant goal. If you ask 100 psychologists, you're going to get 100 different answers, and primarily, you're probably going to get something within one of two camps. You're going to have the naturalists who do believe that we are just, you know, a giant meat machine made up of carbon, and you know, everything can be explained by the brain. And then you have other individuals who kind of get into the more ineffable idea of consciousness, or and I'm going to use that word consciousness or self interchangeably with, you know, the soul or the being or the self. They're all basically the same thing. They're the intangible aspect. So some psychologists would absolutely say that we're just a bunch of deterministic neurons that are firing, and we could, you know, scientifically, eventually we're going to be able to tell what everybody's going to do before they do it. And other psychologists are going to say that we're more ineffable, and there's a bigger question out there rather than just the neurons firing off.
Now, do they really have, does the concept of evil fall into that category of kind of many people leaning towards one or the other? Like, can evil be explained through actions and through prior circumstances that create evil? Or is evil some sort of evolutionary thing that has been created with human beings? Like, what is evil? What is evil to you?
Well, it's kind of just a common thing that we tend to think of evil as being something that is subjectively bad. You know, if we're going to look at it from a subjective or objective standpoint, objectively, evil is something that is that is going to harm someone or something at the expense, or it's going to give gain to somebody at the expense of somebody else, without really looking into how that's going to affect that person or that other being. You know, when it comes to evil, it's a very unique human idea, because if you ask an individual if harming an animal could be evil, I think a lot of people would say, yes, that is evil or it's wrong. But if you look at two animals that are going to harm each other for their own sustenance, we don't believe that animals have that concept of evil.
That's nature to us.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's something that we as humans, because through evolution and through our own development of technology and kind of how our lives have become easier, we're able to kind of sit back and ponder things that, you know, I don't think other animals really get to do. They have to survive. We have the luxury of being able to sit back and think about things that it's something that's relatively new. There weren't a lot of philosophers 100 or 200 years ago because everybody was worried about getting to tomorrow. Now we get to sit back and think about those things a lot more, and we can kind of debate the concept of evil and good and how that plays within humans.
Do you think that it was used as an evolutionary advantage for our ancestors? And is that why even evil is kind of so embedded in our characteristics as a natural thing? Because evil is, in a sense, what you're kind of describing, like it could be looked at as a selfish act, to act yourself, but it would benefit only you and harm others. But in nature, or even our ancestors, that may be why we became, or, you know, got this far as a civilization.
Absolutely. And when we get into looking at what we consider to be evil, or the act, whether we consider the action of someone to be evil, again, it's very subjective. And if you look at the field of history, one of the things that I remember from freshman history classes was history is written by the winners. And if the winner of a certain conflict sees that they have progressed their people, their family, themselves, they're not necessarily going to consider what they did to be evil. They're going to consider it to be something that is necessary. So we can get into some really uncomfortable, especially, you know, because we have so much time to sit and think about what people did in the past versus what we would do today. We can have some very uncomfortable thoughts about what our ancestors did, but in the moment, they probably didn't see it as evil, or they saw it as something that they needed to accomplish.
Interesting. So evil, in a sense, is malleable towards the time, place, relevancy of era that you're in society. So I can see that, in a sense, because I mean, animals may look at another animal like a bear. I know bears are notorious for attacking other bears, like children, to stop their DNA from spreading. And it, in their eyes, it's evil. I would assume it looks evil as another bear would attack, but it is, in a sense, a natural. It's because of the way that they're evolving. Like if bears were humanistic, it's strange how that works throughout time. And now we're becoming so conscious and sensitive and woke, in a sense, where we're noticing the evils around the world, in history, just the way in our nature. And is that necessarily, like, do you think people are born evil? Do you think that that's something that is embedded in us? Or do you think that evil is a developed characteristic that will eventually go away?
I think if we look at evil from the perspective of what the majority would be considering evil, so I'm kind of using the word to describe the word, but you know, those activities that we, in general, as a society, see as repugnant. So people who harm vulnerable individuals, children, people with disabilities or the elderly, we really tend to see those people as doing something evil. People who commit mass atrocities, you know, serial killers, for the most part, I think a majority of society has kind of come together and said, this is what we consider to be evil. Mm-hmm. And since we have those things, evil is something that we can categorize a group of individuals. If we consider them to be evil, they're people that we want to cast out from our society, from our culture, because they're inevitably going to harm us. Mm-hmm. So from an evolutionary perspective, evil is a good category of people that we don't, that we want to put into an area where they can't harm. Now, you use that term as we start to get more socially conscious, as we get woke, then the concept of evil really becomes more subjective because, there's probably 150 million people who think in the United States that thinks that the other 150 million people are evil for what they're doing and vice versa. So yeah. Political evil and actual malice and things that have a huge impact on society are very different.
Yeah, interesting. So now, that being said, so someone who does commit these acts of evil, and we put these, we label them as different things, whether they're evil knowingly or unknowingly, that would be considered a sociopath, psychopath? Is that what we would call them today?
There are individual, if we're looking at a categorization, I would say that every psychopath is evil, but not everybody who's evil is a psychopath. And I think we can say the same thing for sociopaths as well.
Okay.
And there is a vast difference between people who engage in an evil behavior versus somebody who is consistently doing things that are evil. And those tend to be the people that we kind of categorize as sociopaths and psychopaths.
Interesting. So is evil, when evil springs up in people, is it a natural occurrence or is it something... is it a mutation? Is it a mutation in a human characteristic, or is it just a product of society?
I hate to take the easy way out, but it's really both. Now, if you're going to ask me which one is, that's the classic nature versus nurture debate.
Yeah.
I think that there are people who have a predisposition for any type of psychopathological issue. That genetic or natural predisposition is what we call the diathesis stress model, or the vulnerability to psychopathology. And basically what that means is everybody has the, deep inside, everybody has the ability to do something evil. Everybody has the ability to be evil, but it takes a certain triggering event for that evil to come out. For myself, I tend to see that I tend to hope that I'm a very even tempered person. However, if somebody were to harm my daughter, I would probably engage in some pretty evil behavior. I would at least cognitively think about doing some very evil behavior that I wouldn't do normally. So there is that stressor that comes in, and everybody has a different level to which they can control themselves before they do something.
Interesting. So does a brain scan show evil? Does chemical testing show psychopathy, something like that?
We can definitely see things through, neurological testing. We do know that there have been different parts of the brain that are slightly different in, say, serial killers. But it definitely, there's no definitive picture that we could take. There's no CT scan. There's no functional MRI that we can take and say, boom, this person is a serial killer. We probably could look at an fMRI. If we gave everybody an fMRI once every 2 or 3 months, we could probably say this person is much more likely to engage in an evil behavior. But that's not, we're not in the Minority Report era where we can have precognition of what's going to happen. There's that nature and nurture. Somebody may be very predisposed to doing something, but they never do it. A great example of this, or a great analogy, would be addictions. You can have somebody who has a high predisposition for alcoholism, but if they never take a drink, they're never going to become an alcoholic. So if an individual has a high predisposition to maybe engage in violent or evil behavior, but they never have a tipping point, they never have an event happen to them, okay, they will never actually engage in that behavior.
Interesting. Okay. So what, for people who don't know, what would you classify like a psychopath and a sociopath? What are the differences between the two?
There's a lot of discussion within the psychological and the criminal justice community about what the difference is. The thing that I always kind of go back to is a psychopath is an individual who is more than likely has a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. And the key point of antisocial personality disorder is that lack of empathy, that when they engage in a behavior, they really don't feel it. They are the cold and methodical individual, where the sociopath is more the hot-blooded, hot-tempered person. You know, in 2020, the individuals who are out, and I'm not saying protests are bad, but you know, the people who were really hot and bothered about politics, the people who were really out on the streets and yelling about, you know, not liking their political opponent, that's, I'm not saying they're a sociopath, but that's an indicative behavior of a sociopath. They're hot and they're hot-blooded, where the psychopath is the person who's quiet and really devoid of emotion, but still doing a lot of the same things.
Interesting. So the sociopath's kind of like acting in a sense, like the emotions out, where the psychopath kind of doesn't even, they kind of just roll over and like doesn't know how to.
That's a good way of putting it. If you want to use probably one of the most famous characters in the last 20 or 30 years, Hannibal Lecter from Signs of the Lambs would be a psychopath. Because when he's, if you've seen the movies, when he's killing someone, I don't remember exactly how it goes in the movie, but they basically say that his blood pressure never goes above, you know, or his pulse never goes above like 80 beats per minute. Where a sociopath would be, you know, flushed face and their blood pressure would be up. The psychopath can do that evil thing and be completely calm about it.
Interesting. So, which one is more dangerous to the world? Are they? I know they're both kind of do their own different damages to people in society, but and some of them are functional and don't. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
the bad ones, I know. I would assume Epstein would be a psychopath, right? Someone like him? Or would that be a sociopath?
A lot of times there's overlay between the two.
Okay.
You know, go back to the first question is which one's more dangerous? In the moment, the sociopath is more dangerous when they're engaging. The psychopath is much more dangerous in the long term. Mm. And what you also have to remember is a lot of times, especially with the psychopath, they're going to engage in these pathological behaviors over a long duration of time. And because they're not, you know, they're not passionate and they're not yelling while they're doing it, it may go on for years and years and years and you never know. A lot of the business type psychopaths, people like Bernie Madoff, who was stealing money for decades and didn't care, you know, didn't care about anybody. I would also probably say, you know, Epstein, you know, he was just doing these things and he wasn't, not having been around him personally, but it doesn't seem like he was, you know, really emotional about it. It seemed like that was, he was just going about his day harming people. So in the long term, the psychopath is going to do more harm because we're not seeing it. But the sociopath is somebody who could, with that big burst of emotion, with that hot, passionate emotion, can do a lot in the moment.
Interesting. Now, are these people, like how addiction is kind of, there's a big argument if it's a choice or if it's a disease. Is psychopathy, in a sense, something in the same area? Like, should we have sympathy for these people who have turn into these monsters of people? Like, as you kind of stated before, it's a mixture of nature and nurture, but mm-hmm. but along life circumstances, no one just is born as an Epstein, someone along the lines he was created down that way. Should we as a society feel sympathy for all types of these people that life kind of put them that way? Is there rehabilitation for it?
So the simple answer is, you know, you can hate the behavior and not hate the person. So you can feel sympathy for the individual while still really despising the behavior that they're engaging in. The caveat to that when it comes to the sociopath or the psychopath is the behavior is really who they are. It's not that they're engaging in a behavior that's a one-off, or it's not that they're shoplifting because it was, they just had an opportunity. It's really ingrained in who they are. In the question of rehabilitation, that is something that researchers have been looking at for a very long time. And it's one of the hardest things to answer because the psychopath is so good at manipulation, at emotional manipulation, that even if you believe that you are rehabilitating that person, a lot of times they know better about the social situation and social engineering that they can manipulate it to where they appear to have been rehabilitated when, you know, the face appears to be, they'll put on a new mask, but what's inside hasn't changed a bit. So until we can see what's in a man's heart, we're never going to know if somebody can be really rehabilitated.
So they can go under the radar and probably have been for a long time without displaying their evil. And if they really wanted to, they can kind of, like you said, put on that mask. So my question would be, like, how many of them are among us? And like, is society kind of fueling more of it? Is it better to be a psychopath in today's world and to kind of think, be selfish and only fight for yourself in a sense and be greedy? I mean, that's kind of what modern day world is creating human beings to be.
Yeah. I have to start by ethically saying, no, it is not better to be a psychopath.
Okay. Yeah.
So after officially making that statement, there are benefits without a doubt. You know, going back to, you know, the question of how many are out there, generally we think that about 2% of the population would fall under the criteria of a psychopath. Not everybody's a serial killer, not everybody's an Epstein, not everybody's a Madoff, but 1% to 2% we think fit into that psychopathy of being a psychopath. It probably is a little bit more because, again, that 2% number are the ones that we can kind of get our heads wrapped around. The scarier thing is there's probably 1 or 2 or 3% out there that are so good that we don't know.
Yeah.
And those are the ones we have to be really scared of.
Yes. And that's the way that you describe them too, about how they're good at faking emotions and almost just being rising to the top easier than other people who have more empathy. It makes you think that's why a lot of them seem to appear on top of society and running things globally.
Yeah.
And all these people who really hold world's wealth. It makes a lot of sense. And it feels like modern society is fueling that. Like it's an inevitable path that human characteristics are just evolving to go towards, because you would be more successful and you would be better off in society at some point, developing that, which is kind of scary to think about. So is it passed down through like epigenetics? Is that behavior learned through offspring? Like, because you can learn positive traits. You could, fear is passed down and trauma is passed down through actually generation right after yours. So is evil thinking.
And so that really goes back to that nature-nurture question that if anybody's taken a basic Psych 101 class, you should probably have been just beat over the head that psychologists, really the only way we can test that is through tests of monozygotic twins, identical twins that are raised apart. Mm. And that just doesn't happen a whole lot. So we really don't know the nature-nurture piece. We do know that there is there definitely is some epigenetics going on. But the question is, if my forefathers have passed along these genes to me, I'm also getting reinforced through their behaviors. Mm-hmm. So it definitely is, it's not nature or nurture. It is nature and nurture.
Interesting.
The piece that I always look at, and this guy kind of go back to my work as a behaviorist, I can't change somebody's genetic makeup. And, you know, in a world where CRISPR and other ways of changing DNA may be in the future, you know, I may be on the outs eventually, but I'm pretty safe for a while. I can work on somebody's behavior. I can't work on their genetics. So I tend to focus on, you know, what we can do versus what is maybe causing it, you know, but we can't really do anything about the cause. We can only really work on, you know, what we can have an effect on.
Yeah. Do you think that the population of them are increasing, minus not taking into consideration the population of us is increasing, but is society pumping out more of them?
I personally don't think so. I personally think that, and at this point I start to sound like I need to get in my rocking chair and sit on the porch and yell at kids because I'm getting old, but I feel like that society is showing it more, that social media, the fact that, you know, the attention span of individuals, of what can get your attention, you know, it's downwards to like 6 seconds, you know, back when we had Vine, now we have TikTok, and people have to do some pretty outlandish things to get people's attention. You know, we're seeing it more. We're seeing things. And a lot of times these things are becoming entertainment. I know I'm not alone as a person who has a strange fascination with watching things like ID, Investigation Discovery, and what some people call like murder porn type television shows. Mm-hmm. It's entertaining. I just a couple of weeks ago watched a whole documentary about Aaron Hernandez, who was the New England Patriot tight end who killed, well, I believe his conviction stood. So yeah, he killed a couple of people, and he had seemed to have everything. You know, is that sociopath? Is that psychopath? I don't know. I know that he had some pretty significant issues. But yeah, we're seeing it more frequently because we have the ability to see things and we're being entertained by it. So it's a strange phenomenon.
Yeah, it is. What about like gray areas with that? Like, do you think that people who are truly, truly evil, who report that they don't have control over their evil, like they are not the ones committing those acts, mm-hmm. Do you think that that is true? And do you think that they're really perceiving that as what it is? Or do you think that they really do not have control over their actions?
So that gets into a very deep and interesting conversation of what is the self? Who is, you know, I am this meat machine made up of carbon, and everybody who sees me, this is Brad. And I'm just, I'm the carbon-based being. However, everybody has different entities that, different personalities. And I know probably we're looking at, you know, going into maybe dissociation a little bit here. And, you know, from a clinical perspective, there definitely is still some controversy about what dissociation and dissociative identity disorder, formerly multiple personality, really what that is, because we all have different personalities. This is not how I talk when I'm, you know, out with friends. Mm-hmm. When I'm out with friends, if I sat and started lecturing to them, I wouldn't have any friends very soon. So we all have different personalities. We all have different ways of being. But then the question becomes, what happens? Is there that ability to truly split? And most clinicians, you know, it used to be about a 50-50 of clinicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers who, you know, kind of bought into DID versus didn't. I think that number is getting higher now because we have more access to being able to see people. But the defining split when I was going through grad school was, when I talked to professors, it would be whether or not they had actually worked with somebody. who had DID. And for those that had DID, the ones who had a patient who had DID, that was, they truly believed that it was there. And people who hadn't yet experienced yet, they didn't quite buy into it.
Interesting.
And so it's a hard diagnosis to really get your head wrapped around, because we all dissociate. The key there, going back to kind of the question of culpability or being held accountable, is that fugue state, that amnesia with DID. When I'm Brad at home, I remember it. Sitting here, I know how I act differently. I know I act differently with my daughter than I do with my clients, than I do with my friends. A person with DID will almost necessarily have amnesia, to where those different personalities are completely unique. And then there are some individuals with DID where those personalities actually have some form of communication. So it's, to answer the question of, you know, how do we deal with those individuals? We really have to look at it on a case-by-case basis and see what the behavior is and what led up to it. And it's going to be unique on each individual.
Interesting. That is very interesting, because I know that there are cases where some people, this might not be true, but do some people actually have DID so severely that their other personalities actually are like diabetic and other ones aren't? Like one needs insulin and the other one isn't? Or is that just a power of the mind type of thing?
There are individuals. So diabetic is kind of a difficult one, because, you know, that's blood sugar, kind of insulin, and you know, the mind can actually influence that, even without DIDs, you know. But I have read case studies of individuals who, you know, have very definitive characteristics between the different personalities. I've actually read some, and again, I would really, before I would stake my reputation on these things being accurate, I would like to be able to see them firsthand. But I've read articles where people claim that that different personalities have different eye colors, or I even read, and I wish I could find this one, that somebody claimed to have a different, I want to say blood type. And to me, I guess I didn't pass chemistry well enough or biology to understand how that could even be possible. But there are some things that we definitely know, like some that need medications that don't need up when the other personality comes out, or when the alter is there. Vision is a big one, where some alters in other personalities, one will need glasses and then they'll switch to a different alter, and that person will take off the glasses because they don't need the prescription. So there's a lot of strange things out there.
Wow, that's interesting. So it sounds like there's some gray areas a little bit, stuff that we just don't know. So how would you, I got into this show on Netflix. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but one of the things that started really getting me diving down the rabbit hole of this concept of evil was the show on Netflix called Evil. And yeah, it's about demonic possessions and psychology kind of clashing, where this psychologist gets hired on with this priest, and they basically have to work for the church and kind of go around and investigate and cover up like possessions and exorcisms for the church. And the psychologist is giving her take on every situation. And on one scene in particular, there was this woman who was supposedly possessed, and there was two like master psychologists and then a priest and another like master priest. And they were like having this really like heavy debate on if this girl was possessed or if this girl needed medical attention and if she had some sort of mental disease. And they both couldn't figure it out, because there was this gray area where it's like, if she's not in control, and if it is, even if it is considered DID, how does it rule out that it's not some sort of other, I know it sounds woo-woo, but how does it not sort out what people believed for thousands of years, that demons possess human beings and it's something else taking over your personality? Like, that scene was so fascinating to me. It's like, do we even have an answer for that, or is that still up in the air?
philosophically, I can't say that we absolutely know that demonic possession doesn't exist. Now, as a psychological scientist, there's much more evidence that demonic possession is not something that we can replicate. It's not something that we can see. But, you know, if I take off my psychologist hat and I just put on my, I'm a normal human being and I'm just, you know, intrigued by this, you know, a demonic possession wouldn't necessarily always be the same for every single situation. So, you know, it's interesting because in a situation like that, and I know that, you know, it's, that is partially for entertainment, so it probably plays it up a little bit, but both individuals, so let's just say there's only two, there's the scientist and there's the religious individual. Both of them want the same thing, which is to alleviate the suffering of the individual. And if one can't do it, the other one is going to assume that they can. And in that situation, both of them are failing because there's something we don't understand about the human condition, about consciousness. Mm. What's really intriguing is an individual who I would, you know, as a clinician, I would look at and say that person definitely is suffering from some type of psychological disorder. They may actually get more benefit from a religious intervention because that's what they need. Mm. And so that goes back to, you know, that the beginning of why I love this field and why it also drives me just bonkers is that there, it's a science, but there is that art, and it's, you have to sometimes meet the person where they need to be and give them what they need, even though it may not be the thing that scientifically looks like it's warranted. We all know the power of the placebo effect, but we don't understand why it works. And that, in a nutshell, is psychology. You know, we don't know why it works, but it works. So why wouldn't we do it? Well, because it doesn't actually work, and we talk ourselves into a giant circle.
That's very fascinating. That's a very, I wonder if we'll ever kind of figure that out or not. And if that's something that is kind of like the consciousness, where it's kind of out of grasp because it's not physically something we can really, you know, give words to. Kind of like hallucinations and stuff, or near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. Those of similar takes, you know, like you can't, it's almost like perspective-based. But it's very, very fascinating. Have you ever encountered someone maybe who was displaying, have you ever worked with people who were like displaying evil or displaying psychopathy? What do you do for someone to kind of make them more sociable or just can weave them into society better? Is there hope?
There is. There's hope. It is incredibly difficult. The first thing that we all have to realize, and one thing that I realized very early on, is that I'm never going to have somebody knock on my door or call me or email me and say, I'm a psychopath, I need to work on this. Because if they're a functional psychopath, a functional sociopath, they're fine with who they are. So most of the time, a clinician is going to get that individual because they're going to be sent to them. They're going to be appointed by the court or appointed by somebody because they need to be helped. And a lot of times they don't see like they need to change and they don't need to get any help. So unfortunately, a lot of times the only time that intervention will work, again, I'm going to go back to, it's very similar to addictions. Most people who struggle with addictions will try to stop and try to get help it's not an exaggeration, say hundreds of times, but until they hit rock bottom, until they realize they can't keep doing what they're doing, they're never going to fully buy into needing to change their behavior. And the same thing really goes for somebody who's struggling with psychopathy. When it no longer works for them, that's the time where they're finally going to be okay with working on themselves. But even that in and of itself is a manipulation of the psychopathic mind. I can't go any further with this, so now I need to figure out what my next role is. And so I don't want to make this sound like it's completely pessimistic and the end is nigh. We can't do anything about it, but it is very, it's one of the most difficult things in the film, in the realm of psychopathology.
Wow. Wow. Reality that we really don't know the full extent of how far it reaches and really how far it goes up, because that's another thing that kind of always plays in my mind about how evil people can climb that ladder quickly and now to the positions that they're in. But it's very interesting that we even have people out there who kind of work towards uncovering them and learning more about how to help these people, because I think that you see it in the same way, like that these people are suffering and they need help and not just forgotten about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I appreciate you coming on. I'm glad I got to have this interview with you. I've been wanting to do this for a while. So hopefully we can get you on here again. We can talk about some cool topics. For all the people who are listening, if you want to give a little information on where they can reach at.
Absolutely. You can catch me on my website, my clinical website, which is mbpsi.com. You can email me at brad@mbpsi.com. Feel free to send any inquiries or just any questions. Try to get back to anybody as quickly as possible.
Awesome. All right, guys. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for another episode. If you liked it, make sure you go and contact Brad. If you want to have any questions for him, make sure you subscribe to the channel. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, hit that thumbs up or like button, or even share this podcast with some friends. And make sure you subscribe to my channel and all listening platforms to stay up to date with all the new content coming out. That's the Matt Rich Podcast on all listening platforms. If you'd like to support the channel, visit my Patreon at patreon.com/thematrichpodcast. I love you all, and I will see you next time.